Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, back from vacation. Man, do we have a lot of news to catch up on. Heather Parton from Salon will help me get caught up with all the major headlines and news you may have missed. Progressive superstar Tom Hartman will join us to discuss his new book, The Hidden History of Monopolies, How Big Business Destroyed the American Dream. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us a favor, support the show. We are busting down the firewall during COVID, probably through the election. Well, certainly COVID is going to last through the election, but we want everybody to hear every minute of the show. But we still need support to do it. And you can become a member and a supporter over at ROFpodcast.com. That's ROFpodcast.com. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon. And of course, the popular blog, Hullabaloo. So, Heather, we've got a lot to talk about this week. Also about last week, I was on vacation, and we didn't really have a chance to touch on the RNC. We touched on the DNC a little bit before I left. Why don't we start there? Because really, it is what the past week and a half, 2 weeks have been about for me, largely speaking. You know, of course, we had the EPA roll back protections for our water and our air. Donald Trump was, off his rocker in multiple instances. Of course, we've had everything that has happened in Kenosha, the violence there and in Portland. But what has really struck me is that it is really coming into focus what the president's campaign strategy is. And we can start with the RNC, because I feel like I don't want to say there's a carrot in a stick. I don't think that's the right really metaphor, but there is a defensive mechanism, or I should say a defensive strategy and an offensive strategy that seems to be operating simultaneously. The defensive one seems to have been on display at the RNC, which is we're going to give license to suburban Republican women to vote for Donald Trump. We're going to all that talk about him being racist and anti-immigrant and anti-women. The RNC had more people of color speak at their convention than work in the entire administration. I'm not being facetious. They had a naturalization ceremony. They had a pardoning ceremony. It seems to me it was all geared towards keeping those suburban women who we hear and Donald Trump, and you know, it was their strategy, because Donald Trump, he has no ability not to say the subtext. So every interview that he's had after that, he's talking about the women and the housewives. So that to me is fascinating. That was one element. And then the other element you wrote about this week. But let's start with the RNC. Give me your impressions of it.
Well, I mean, look, it was, you know, first of all, this gigantic pageant at the White House with the flags, and, you know, they had the speeches, the pre-recorded speeches that they did in this big auditorium with more flags, and they had Mike Pence at Fort McHenry, you know, rockets red glare, and, you know, I mean, they did this full sort of, you know, very, you know, frankly, fascistic pageantry using the White House, which is offensive and odious in every respect, since that's normally
and illegal.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, they had Marines involved. They had, you know, I mean, this was it was a grotesque sort of, you know, display of complete lack of interest or concern about ethics at all. In fact, there was reporting in the New York Times that, you know, Trump actually was getting off on it, getting off on the fact that people were upset about it and there was nothing they could do about it. You know, and in fact, he alludes to this in his big speech, saying, you know, I'm in the White House and they're not, you know, this kind of, and which is one of his favorite sayings, being unaware apparently that it's a Chevy Chase, you know, punchline from the 1970s on Saturday Night Live.
Right.
But in any case, he, you know, this whole thing, this whole big pageant was sort of done with the idea of presenting this image of great power. While at the same time, you're absolutely right, they know that they have this tremendous weakness with women. I mean, the polling that's come out since the conventions shows this chasm. Also, by the way, losing people, losing men. You know, he still has a slight advantage with men, but it's nothing compared to what it was in 2015. But with the suburban women, with women generally, urban, suburban, any other kind, he is in, you know, in grave trouble. So they thought what they'd do is they'd trot out people of color, they'd trot out women to talk about, oh, he called me when I had my surgery, and he's such a kind and gentle man. And, you know, you can say that stuff all you want. And the people of color, I'm not going to say they weren't sincere in their belief. I mean, you know, they're not a monolith, and I'm sure they're plenty of people who, you know, not plenty, but there are some people of color in this country who actually like Donald Trump. But it's completely lacking in credibility because we know what we see Donald Trump every day. We know what he is. We know what he's like. And, you know, for the women that, you know, he keeps going on TV and saying, well, all they care about is security. All the women, they want safety. And what
soccer
he doesn't
moms.
Understand,
soccer moms.
Yeah, the
security
the
moms.
You know, the security moms. Well, what he doesn't understand is when, you know, it let's just, you know, for the sake of argument, say that's true. Well, that is one of the reasons why they hate him, because he is a chaos agent, and it is absolutely, you know, nothing feels more insecure than having a man who goes up and says you should drink bleach in the middle of a raging, deadly pandemic. I mean, this is the kind of thing that should scare everybody. So, you know, that part of it, you're absolutely right. And then you had this display of power, and of course, then you had the Nuremberg ralliers like, you know, Kimberly Guilfoyle and Trump Jr. and Matt Gaetz and, you know, the rest of these people who were up there just screaming about law and order and talking about how Donald Trump is the only one who, basically saying, he'll go in and bring the hammer down, people. He's going to do it. He's going to bring in the troops, and we're going to smash these people, these protesters, these, you know, resistors to the regime. We're going to take care of it. So it was weirdly discordant to me. As I watched it, you know, it wasn't entirely, you know, it wasn't so unsuccessful that they were, like, missing their cues and stuff like that, you know, which I think maybe I sort of expected because it was such a slapdash effort.
Right.
But when they settled on this format of this big state pageant, that actually worked for them on the sort of technical level. But as far as the actual, you know, the impression they were trying to give, it was weird. It was these two things that don't really mesh together. And that they didn't really, I think that was probably Trump's doing, or probably the analysts were telling him, you know, the strategists, I mean, were saying, look, you know, you got to do something for these women. We're just bleeding suburban women. You got to give them something. And yet Trump was in there going, no, we got to have law and order. And those two things seemed to kind of clash. But as we come into, as they left that convention, it's clear which strategy won out on that. The kind and gentle president who was, you know, welcoming immigrants into the White House and swearing them in as Americans has completely disappeared. And the fascist, you know, president who's going to send in troops to, quote, what is it, anarchist cities? Is that what he's calling them now?
Right.
That is what they're going in through to the November election. That and trying to create chaos and invalidate the election. I think it's pretty obvious that those are the two things they're going to run with for the next 60 days, and we can forget anything else. That's how they're that's the decision they've made, to just create utter chaos wherever they can.
Okay, so and so that is the, you know, that was the sort of the soft pitch, because I think the campaign must know that they are not going to beat Joe Biden in the popular vote, right? I think they must realize that their only way that they're going to eke this out, and it's going to be eked out, is to essentially hold the numbers they had last time. I think they've realized at this point that they cannot quite damage Joe Biden in the way that they damaged Hillary Clinton. And I think that's a function of just, you know, of a myriad of things about Joe Biden and about Hillary Clinton, including gender, but also ranging through, like, you know, there was a huge cottage industry about Hillary Clinton. And
yeah,
she has been the, you know, the sort of the bane of the right for, you know, decades, whereas Joe Biden has just been some guy, essentially.
And the media was much more of an accomplice, I think, to Trump in 2016 than they have been
indeed
this time. Directly, in their direct hostility toward Hillary.
And I think there was, I think the Clinton campaign, and then you had the Comey stuff and et cetera. And then I think there were some major failings by the campaign. I don't know that the Biden campaign's not also going to make major failings, but presumably they're not going to be overconfident about, you know, Wisconsin. And Michigan and Pennsylvania, presumably, let's hope. All right. So with all that said, though, so the Trump, it seems to me that the 1-2 punch for the Trump campaign is, on one hand, hold, if they can, those suburban women, hope that they break again for Trump. Because he's just not as bad as the libs or the Dems or, you know, the socialists say. And then it seems to me they are going to have a strategy, and they're going to try and eke out a couple of states. They only won 3 states, remember last time, but you know this, by 70,000 votes over the course of 3 states. I mean, that is like, I don't even know how you measure how small of a percentage that is. And so I think what we're going to see is you start to see this. They've been ramping up, but Bill Barr got into the game this week where they are. It is full on. They are trying to discredit those mail-in ballots, not even the process. Now they're trying to say the mail-in ballots are questionable. And Bill Barr this week, Donald Trump this week, encouraged people to vote twice by mail. And I think that the reason why they're doing this is it's just one more element so that when those mail-in ballots come, they're going to deploy a bunch of different strategies to try and keep them from being counted. And Bill Barr was on, I mean, this is just shocking, was on television with, I think it was Wolf Blitzer, saying like, well, I'm not sure if voting twice on purpose is illegal. I don't know the laws of the state. Everyone knows that voting twice is illegal. It is, I think it's even a felony. And everyone knows this. I think the chief law enforcement officer of the country does. So we're starting to see this. And, you know, you wrote about the right wing violence. I think that's going to play a part in it, too, because, you know, you and I both still very clearly speaking for you, but I suspect this is true. Remember what happened in Florida in 2000. And I would be very surprised if that's not a model, except for this time, these guys are not going to be wearing Brooks Brothers outfits. But they're going to look a little bit more, I guess, dangerous. And they could very well interfere with the counting of ballots that come in the day after, or I should say that start the counting that starts the day after Election Day, because a lot of these states are going to be decided days after election night. And I think has got to become, and I don't even know what the Democrats can do to prepare for this. Get their own squads of people? I'm not sure.
Well, I think that when they do this counting, I think that in most states, and this is another part of the problem, right? Every state has its own processes and has its own laws on this. And some states, they have to be postmarked. You know, they have to arrive on by Election Day. Others, they have to be postmarked by Election Day. I mean, this is a very, it's a confusing situation in the best of, you know, even when you didn't have a president who was going out of his way, or a full campaign, a full party, actually, going out of their way to try and discredit the results. But, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. They will have you know, they are deploying scores of lawyers all over the country. They have an entire group. I've written about this for many years. After the 2000 election, I used to write a lot about it. And we've had all this voting, you know, voter fraud nonsense going on for many years, and vote suppression, et cetera. They have a group called the Republican National Lawyers Association. And they were formed back in the 80s when Jesse Jackson managed to register all those people to vote for his Rainbow Coalition, for his, and it scared the Republicans. They saw this coming and went, oh, my God, we've got to work on this. We've got to get, you know, so they put together this group called the Republican National Lawyers Association. And they specialize in these, and they are very, very, you know, well-schooled in the election laws of every state, every locality, everything. And they are prepared to go in wherever it's necessary. That's what happened in 2000. All those people flew in, and it included people like John Bolton. It included people like Chief
John
Justice
Roberts.
John Roberts was part of this. You had Roger Stone out directing, you know, protesters from a trailer down the street to the Brooks Brothers riot. I mean, this was a well-coordinated pushback because they planned for this stuff. That's part of it. That's just Republican stuff. That has nothing to do with Trump. But, it, you know, if they're going all in with him on this, they have that going for them. Now, I think that part of what Trump was saying this week, if you have to listen to what he exactly said, was telling people to do, he said, I want you to mail in your ballot. Then on Election Day, I want you to go down to the polling place and ask them if your ballot has been, quote, tabulated, counted. He used both of those words, counted or tabulated. And if it's not, vote again to make sure that your vote is counted. And then later they tried to say he was trying to, you know, test the system. But in reality, what does that sound like if that actually happened? Let's just say you've got, you know, a bunch of yahoos in North Carolina, Trump voters, ha ha ha, armed perhaps, deciding to go into polling stations and saying, I sent in my mail-in ballot. Where is it? Did I vote? I want you to do this. Now, of course, they can check that online, but that's not what Trump said to do. Trump said, go down to your polling station. What this is part of, a strategy, and I don't know whether Trump himself has thought this through or whether or not this is just his instinctive, you know, sort of feral instinct on how to do something like this, is to go in and create chaos on Election Day as well, not just after the fact to count, but to actually turn Election Day itself into a complete mess with people going in and, you know, telling the poll workers, you know, I get to vote, and wait a minute, my vote hasn't counted, and where's my vote, and, you know, doing stuff like this. I mean, it's an attempt on all levels, you're absolutely right, from any number of directions to turn this election into total chaos with the goal of basically invalidating it and saying this wasn't a fair election, everything about it. And you had Bill Barr with Wolf Blitzer. He got really agitated when he started talking about this. I mean, I've never seen him like this. I mean, there was a flash of real anger in him saying, this is, you know, I know this is unconscionable. This is, you know, playing with fire. You're doing this and talking about foreign countries coming in and counterfeiting ballots and stuff. This is what they're doing. And, you know, I don't know where this goes. And I don't know what Democrats, how do you prepare for something like this? I honestly don't know. And you can't trust the courts. I mean, they've been, you know,
right before we started talking, you know, I looked up I looked up to double check this. I know that the Wisconsin Supreme Court is dominated by conservatives. I know that the Michigan Supreme Court is dominated by conservatives. Now, back in Florida 2000, everyone was shocked that the Supreme Court took the case from the Florida State Supreme Court because voting is the purview of the states. Sad to say, it should not be, but it is. And I mean, envisioning a situation where Michigan or Wisconsin, one of those states, somebody tries to appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States, and John Roberts says, "We're staying out of it. Well, I don't want this on my record this time." But these two state Supreme Courts, I mean, I would say that not only was Trump calling for disrupting the voting process on the day of the election, but if you get a bunch of Republicans who are coming in, I don't know, half a dozen of them, that's all it would take. I mean, I'm talking a half a dozen in a state that get to vote twice. Just because it's a Republican who voted twice doesn't mean that it doesn't mean anything in terms of like the court looking at this and saying we need to invalidate, you know, mail-in ballots or something. I mean, they're just creating so many different, I guess, short circuits, if you will, to this entire process.
Yep.
And that is, you know, like you say, he's a chaos agent, and that's what they're going for. And they're going to be prepared to look and see what that chaos opens up in terms of an opportunity for them. I don't know. I don't know what the Democrats can do to prepare for that. I mean, I can list all the things that they should be doing, but I don't know that that's sufficient. This is what they're, you know, it's much easier to go in and be a wrecker, right? And to just create chaos than it is to sort of anticipate what part of the system is going to break down. And it is terrifying. And I think as we talk here almost at the end of, just before Labor Day, whatever they're going to roll out is going to start rolling out after Labor Day. That's the way this always works. And so I think things are about to get very, very disturbing over the next 60 days or so.
I think so, too. I mean, we've all been saying that. You know, I remember writing a piece 6 months ago, you know, hey, everybody gird yourself. This is going to be an ugly campaign. Things are going to get, you know, crazy. He's going to try and, steal the election. I mean, all this kind of stuff. But here we are, and we're seeing it. We're seeing it unfold. And I think it is true. Now, it's possible that if the Democrats are able to produce such a huge, you know, turnout, a huge vote that is not even remotely close enough in these swing states that they can justify some kind of, you know, questioning the outcome. And more Democrats vote in person than we're currently thinking they're going to. You know, they defy the pandemic or vote early, you know, in these sort of early voting states where you can go and actually take your ballot down and drop it off. I mean, then they can count it on election night. I mean, there are some scenarios in which we could see that it would be much more difficult for them to challenge the results. But I don't know. We're in the middle of a deadly pandemic. I have no idea what it's going to be like in November. It's not looking good. And, you know, we have, there are an awful lot of, you know, we've got protests going on. I mean, there's a lot going on that could interfere with that. This isn't a normal election. It's not like you can just say, well, we got to go out there and get out the vote, kids. You know, let's really just push it. I mean, in some cases, it's going to be very difficult to do that. So I don't know. I'm terrified of it. I don't know. I think we're in untrod territory here.
Without a doubt.
Very interesting to see how we deal with it.
And I will also say, you know, when you look at what they have been doing in terms of deploying these federal police, you know, secret police It is not hard to imagine that they're going to deploy them in some of the key cities in some of these key states. You know, like in a Milwaukee, in a Detroit, in a Philadelphia. Maybe in St. Paul, let's say. Places maybe where you have Democratic strongholds, and maybe these federal police end up siding with one group or another in the disruption of the counting. I mean, who knows? I think, the point of talking about this is to begin to sort of get people to sort of, contemplate these possible scenarios and to start thinking about, like, what they're going to do about it. And not just, because I don't pretend to have the answer right now, frankly. I don't know if it means get out in the streets. I guess it depends on where you are located and, both located geographically and, in your life. Right. I mean, in
right.
terms of what is where you can be most effective. But I'll tell you this. And this is I'm not suggesting this is really that big of a deal or, sufficient in terms of, addressing what we've just been talking about. But, we're 60 days out. It's going to require a little more thinking, I think, because it really is becoming a little bit starker for me. Like you said, we all talked about this months ago, even years ago but it was all very theoretical. And it's becoming realer and realer as we get closer. But I don't know that I've ever cast a vote for, it's possible, maybe in 08, for the Democratic nominee, because I vote in New York, safe blue state, and have always felt like I don't want really any leader getting that much of a mandate. And I generally wanted to register some measure of discontent with most of these candidates. I am contemplating voting for Joe Biden in New York simply because I think for the first time in my lifetime, the running up the popular vote could have a material impact on the outcome of this election. Because it is undoubtedly going to end up in the courts. And depending on which court it ends up in, the idea that maybe Joe Biden won 10 million more votes than Donald Trump might be relevant to a judge. I don't know that it would be, but it might be. And, that to me is like is quickly coming into focus as a necessity, insufficient, I think, maybe to what we could be facing. But, it don't cost me anything, frankly.
Yeah, exactly.
My usual sort of protest vote was always, something that was just, quite a bank shot anyways. But in this instance, I might want to, if there's any value to my vote in a blue state. This could be one of the few times where there is a significant value. I mean, 5% for a party notwithstanding, et cetera, et cetera. So, but that is something, I know that we're going to return to this theme over the next couple of weeks, maybe, whimsically, or maybe because of things that are actually developing. But if you have anything else, at this point to add, do. Otherwise, we can just talk about this primary that took place in Massachusetts multiple primaries.
I'll just back up what you said. I'm from California. Same thing here. And I'm telling everybody the exact same thing with exactly the same rationale. Look, it's important this time, if not normally, to rack up that popular vote, because we don't know. It could go to the House of Representatives. It could go to the courts. There are lots of reasons why this could be relevant. And for the first time, I think it really does matter. So I think everybody should at least do that. And, I don't know, give money or something. I don't know, although it doesn't look like Joe Biden needs any money. He's got
no.
He broke a record in August
in the history of fundraising for the presidential races. I think he beat Obama's record by, I don't know, $30 million, maybe a little more.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so money is, money doesn't seem to be the object. And, you know, to a certain extent, like, mobilizing people to vote, you know, there's not the same type of field operations that we usually have. I mean, this is going to be a very, very, even if, let's put it this way, even if it wasn't Donald Trump, even if this was, you know, the two blandest candidates you could imagine, you know, like Joe Biden versus Jeb Bush or something, this would be a bizarre election because of COVID. But the COVID is almost like, you know, it's just the ambiance in this instance.
Yeah, exactly.
That is implicating the meal, as it were. but let's talk about this primary in Massachusetts. There were three major primaries that worth talking about. One was the Ed Markey versus Joe Kennedy for the Senate. Joe Kennedy the third, I think it was, or the second, maybe the third. And then in Western Massachusetts, in Massachusetts First District, Richie Neal versus Alex Morse. And Alex Morse was one of the youngest mayors maybe in the history of Massachusetts, but pretty darn close. And he was mayor for 8 years of Holyoke, Mass. During the course of the campaign, there was a smear put out by certain members of, like, college Democrats in that area. And then reporting actually, revealed that it was a smear. Richie Neal, one of the more powerful Democrats in the Democratic caucus, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. People may remember that years ago there was a Medicare for All hearing that the members were told not to use the term Medicare for All when they debated it. Like, don't say those words. Well, that was Richie Neal. He is the largest recipient of corporate PACs in both parties in the House. He has undermined cheap drug legislation. He has undermined, like we said, Medicare for All and other progressive initiatives over the years. So this was a race that was less about Alex Morse, at least from a national perspective, and more about knocking off a member of the Democratic leadership. Well, Morse, unfortunately, from my perspective, was roundly defeated. I think he was, you know, I think just locally, he was just simply not popular enough. He had 8 years as mayor. I don't think he fulfilled maybe his bona fides as a progressive challenger to Neal. The change quotient was just not significant enough. And we have Richie Neal for another 2 years. Now, I guess we will see if this leaves him more vulnerable next time around. But that was that would have been a good one. We would have had Lloyd Doggett come in as chairman of the Ways and Means. That would have been a big deal. You know, these are chair people who are going to be chair people in possibly a majority, right? Senate and House. So, I mean, knock on wood. The flip side of that, Ed Markey defeated Joe Kennedy. The highlights of this one, I think, are one, that Nancy Pelosi weighed in, endorsed Joe Kennedy. Who knows why that was, but the real issue was just that how harshly the leadership in the House responded to any challenges, primaries of any of the House incumbents. And that sort of further sort of like projects this notion that they're just they're about attacking progressives on some level. And Markey, you know, in some ways repackaged himself, But there, you could say it that he repackaged himself as a, you know, more progressive than maybe he's been aggressively in the past, maybe. Or you could say that he is looking where the country is heading and he's willing to follow along and get there. I mean, he has a history of being pretty progressive in the, you know, 80s when he was talking about the Contras and whatnot. But this is what we want our politicians to do, right? To address that. And he's come out strong for the Green New Deal and other things. And he won quite handily. And then there's this empty seat that Joe Kennedy has vacated. And as of now, it is unclear. There are a lot of ballots to be counted, apparently, several thousand. Progressives may have split the vote and left it to a former Republican to fill that seat, who will become the most conservative Democrat, maybe in the House caucus. But hopefully the progressives can pull it out. But that's my, I guess, my report from my home state, as it were. But I don't know. What was your sense of these races from California?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. I loved how you sort of laid that out, because it's sort of my impression of this was, and I looked at it purely from the point of view of how the progressive movement was handling itself in a progressive state in this situation. It seemed to be it was all about Democrats, of course, and you had Neil, who, like, you know, you said it all about him, I think, and, you know, but he is a powerful incumbent, and incumbents do tend to win, and if you're going to challenge an incumbent, you better be pretty good, and you better be really, you know, you must have a good case against the incumbent for the locals so that they understand why it is that they're going to lose a powerful member of Congress for somebody who's brand new, a young guy. And apparently Morse did not manage to do that, disregarding, you know, the churning in that election. There was some really ugly stuff that went on there that probably also hurt him. You know, I mean, I think that was undoubtedly something that people were like, did we really want, you know, to deal with that? The Kennedy Markey race and the Kennedy's empty seat, though, I think is what really interests me, because you see two aspects of the progressive movement, the good and the bad. Because to me, what happened with the Kennedy Markey race, and this is purely, I think, AOC, who had worked with Markey on the Green New Deal, right? I mean, they had already established a relationship, and what she did, and this is really smart. Here she sees. You know, this is why I really have so much respect for her, because I think just as a politician, she's very, very savvy. Markey was a good liberal. Nothing wrong with him. Leaning progressive, definitely open to it. He worked with her. You know, she sees this. Incumbents are powerful. Incumbents can be, you know, and yet here you have, you know, Kennedy, who looks like he's just coming in and saying, hey, it's my turn now, so get out of the way, right? Yeah. He's, you know, there wasn't anything particularly wrong with him in any, you know, substantial way. But come on. Markey was a good guy. No reason to do this other than his ambition, Kennedy's ambition, which was just kind of dripping off of him in this moment, and the backing of the House establishment in doing this. So AOC looks at this and goes, I got this guy, Markey. Now, regardless of where Markey was going to be in terms of issues and his own history, which, you know, he's a pretty, you know, mainstream liberal in many ways, not, you know, probably like me, you know, maybe not as progressive as I am, but, you know, in some respects, yeah. But she saw this as a way to get a big progressive win and do it sort of in contrast to the establishment. And there's nothing cynical about it, because Markey is a good guy and he is working with her and he is moving progressive. But she saw that and basically went for it. And it was a bold thing to do. She went up against Nancy Pelosi by doing it and very openly did it. And that is a progressive win, and a win in a way that just shows that they know how to seek power, right? I mean, you're seeking power. This is a senator, and this is an important state. And now you've got this person, and there's Elizabeth Warren in the other seat there, and you got Markey moving left, and that is a very smart thing to do. Now contrast that with this empty seat there, and you see progressives fighting among themselves and basically being unable to sort of decide who, you know, who has the best chance to win, and ending up with a Republican. And we've seen that here in California. Potentially.
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 There's apparently,
maybe
it
that's
was
not true.
Well, on Thursday of this week, this past week, it was suddenly they found another like 2,500 votes that were uncounted in I think it was Norfolk County. So we'll see.
Maybe.
I think you know.
But
we should...
dynamic there, I think, is clear. Is that you know there and the reason I say that is just because we've had it happen in California, where we have this jungle primary thing, right? And this will happen when you have you know an open seat and you've got you know all the progressives in California just you know in there. Nobody can. Everybody thinks it's their chance, and in slips a Republican because they split the vote. So yep. You know this is the kind of thing that progressives need to think about when they're trying to build power. And so I look at AOC's move on that and I think, wow, see, that was smart. And she went ahead and, you know, she saw, you know, incumbents usually win, right? And so, you know, somehow she looked at that and went, you know, Markey's probably gonna pull this off, and realized that she had a play, you know, she had a play there that was going to build power for the progressive movement, whereas in the other seat it was just kind of flailing. So anyway, that's my impression of that particular race, and I think it's fascinating to watch, and we're going to see, you know, more of this playing out over the next few years as progressives
yep.
start to really make their move.
Indeed. This is it is reminiscent of like you know, the Club for Growth on some level. On the right, and for
yeah.
many years, frustrated, and then you know, and then they get outpaced. You know, I remember Pat Toomey running for Senate a couple yeah. of times. I think it was backed by the Club for Growth, and now that guy is considered, you know, I don't know, in the rational part of the party, and he was he's a lunatic.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
Let us hope that that. On the left, we have something analogous, except for, of course, from my perspective, the lunacy is with those in the center. And this is going to become very important, too, if the Democrats take the Senate, because there is going to be a
Absolutely.
Broad contingency of senators who are all going to be looking to be, you know, around, huddled around that fulcrum. You know, we're going to have not quite Joe Lieberman's, but they're going to be close to Joe Lieberman's. And
Lincoln, how about that?
Yeah, exactly. We will explain that to folks maybe in the coming weeks. Heather, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Walmart, Amazon, Google, and Facebook have become so big that they're able to destroy and corrupt the American economy. But in his new book, The Hidden History of Monopolies, our next guest has laid out how we have broken control of behemoth corporations in the past, how we can do it again. Please welcome to the show progressive superstar, my friend, Tom Hartman. So, Tom, the hidden history of monopolies, we are certainly living in an era, I think, where there has been a lot more understanding and appreciation of how detrimental the concentration of power and money in this country has become. And you basically write that it was not only not always like this, for the most part in this country, it was not like this.
Right. This country was founded in a protest against monopoly power. That was the East India Company, the first modern corporation. By 1770, it was the largest monopoly in the world. And they had a stranglehold on most commerce with North America. You couldn't manufacture fine clothing in the United States, for example. You had to import it from England. And the same with tea. Not that anybody's trying to grow tea here, but it was illegal to bring tea into the United States unless you brought it through the East India Company. But about half the tea being sold in this country back then was being sold by small tea shops that were buying it from smugglers. And the East India Company got Parliament to radically cut the tax on tea, which allowed them to undercut their smuggler competitors, and that so pissed off the colonists that they went out and committed a $1 million act of vandalism, and that was the Boston Tea Party, and that led right straight to the Boston Ports Act, which led to the Boston Massacre, which led to the shot heard around the world, which led to the Declaration of Independence and America. We had monopolies largely under control until the Industrial Revolution, until the, you know, 1880s, 1890s, and Congress passed a law against it, and Teddy Roosevelt started enforcing that in 1905 aggressively. most famously against Standard Oil, but he went against all kinds of trusts. And the last serious enforcement effort that we had in this country was when Richard Nixon took on AT&T, and Jimmy Carter finished that job by breaking them all up. And then Reagan came into office in 81, and in 82, he said, we're just not going to enforce these laws anymore. And as a result, you know, here we are. The small and medium-sized businesses are just basically dead in this country.
I want to get back to the change that Ronald Reagan implemented in terms of the way that we interpret, essentially, the antitrust laws in this country. And I know you've written about that this is basically the borking of America, you call it.
Yes.
But what was the mechanism that Teddy Roosevelt used in 1905 to bust up trusts? Was it, what laws?
In 1890, Congress passed a law called the Sherman Antitrust Act. It was modeled on a law that had been passed a few years earlier in Ohio. Senator Sherman was the U.S. senator from Ohio. And the object of that law in Ohio was John Rockefeller. And what that law said was that when any combination of companies or individual company behaves in such a way as to diminish competition in the marketplace, they shall be declared a trust and they shall be broken up, basically. They are conducting themselves illegally. And there were penalties both for the corporation and for the officers of the corporation. And that was the law. And in the election in 1904, and nobody had enforced that law, by the way. It went on the books in 1890, but it largely got ignored. And in 1904, Teddy Roosevelt was a pretty rich guy from New York, a very wealthy family. And he took a bunch of money from rich guys in New York for his election. And his opponents went after him on that, Eugene Debs and others, really loudly. And he felt pretty stung. And so in 1905, he started enforcing the Sherman Act and went after Standard Oil and a bunch of other companies. It was Taft, the next president, who actually finished the job. But Teddy initiated it. And then in 1907, he also pushed through the passage of the Tillman Act, which made it a federal felony for any corporation to give money or any form of support to any candidate for federal office. That was a law that the Supreme Court struck down with Citizens United.
And the reason why you combine those two things, that that big money influencing politicians and the problem of a concentration of the marketplace, is because largely they have a similar detrimental impact to democracy.
Yeah, monopoly, monopoly not only is the most effective way to suppress competition, which is virtually the definition of monopoly, but it also not only monopolizes economic power, but it monopolizes political power. This was not that big an issue. I mean, it was an issue, but not that huge an issue before 1976. Because we had laws in place that prevented giant corporate monopolies or the billionaires that they spawn from owning our politicians. We had anti-corruption laws, anti-bribery laws. But in 1976, the Supreme Court, and this is the earlier hidden history book, The Hidden History of the Supreme Court, The Betrayal of America, the Supreme Court ruled that if a billionaire wanted to own a politician or even a couple dozen politicians, that was no longer considered corruption or bribery. That was now considered free speech. Money was the same thing as speech. And then 2 years later, and that was the Buckley versus Vallejo decision, 2 years later in the First National Bank versus Bilotti decision, the Supreme Court extended that logic to corporations as well. And then, of course, with Citizens United, they just doubled down on it.
So let's talk about what happened in 1980-81 with the Reagan administration. There was a, I guess you could say, a philosophical change in the way that monopolies, illegal monopolies, as it were assessed, essentially.
Yeah. Just before Reagan was elected, Carter had finished breaking up AT&T. So, I mean, there was a kind of a national consensus that that was a good thing. And also, if you were to go back, if you were to travel across America prior to the Reagan administration, It was a very different country. I was a kid when Route 66, this TV show, came out in 1960. I was 9 years old, and I remember watching this show. It was just fascinating. This was as the Eisenhower highway system was still being built. And so the only way to get from New York to Los Angeles was on a single highway that was only two lanes and most, you know, for most of the way, called Route 66. And Martin Milner and George Maharis, every week they drove their Corvette across the country, and every week they're in a different town having an adventure. And you could always tell where they were because, oh, there's the Biloxi Diner and the Biloxi Hotel and the Biloxi Local Bank and, you know, everything, you know, family-owned businesses, the dry cleaners, the, you know, the hotel, the whatever it may be. And when Reagan and that was America, you know, there was a lot of diversity business wise, a lot of small and medium sized businesses. Banks couldn't do business in more than one state. Insurance companies couldn't do business in more than one state. Credit card companies were had just been given permission by Nixon to do business in more than one state. And that led them all to incorporate in North Dakota so they could rip us off. And America had this extraordinary vitality, business vitality, and it was easy to be an entrepreneur and start your own business. And Reagan came along, and in 82, he said, you know, we're just not going to enforce that Sherman Act anymore. It's an anachronism. The sales pitch that Robert Bork had made was that historically a corporation had a series of constituents that they had to be responsible to, the community in which they operated, their customers, the institution, the corporation itself, their employees, and their stockholders. And Bork and Reagan said, you know, that stuff doesn't matter. The only people who matter are the shareholders, and the only metric that matters is whether prices are going up. And so Reagan said, okay, screw that. We're not even going to enforce that anymore. And that led to the, for those old enough to remember the 80s, that led to the M&A mania, the mergers and acquisition mania, with guys who called themselves, you know, masters of the universe, like Michael Milken, who just made a living slamming companies together. You get, you know, five different hotel, you know, small hotels in a state or hotel chains around the country, and each one has their own marketing department, sales department, and HR department, and accounting department. You slam them all together in one corporation. You can lay off all those extra, you know, divisions, as it were. You only need one. So companies got much more efficient, but there was massive unemployment as a result of this, and it destroyed local economies. I think the inefficiency in this case was actually a good thing. And so now, you know, you could get dropped out of a plane at 90,000 feet and land in any random city in America, and you would have no friggin' clue where you were because it's all the same Olive Garden and the same Marriott and the same McDonald's and the same, you know, chain of movie theaters and everything. I mean, you know, as a result of this, by the way, Sam, the average American is paying $5,000 a year what I call a monopoly tax. It's not paid to the government. It's in higher prices for things. We pay three times the world average for internet service. We pay twice the developed world average for telephone, cell phone service. We pay two to three times the world average for pharmaceuticals. We pay almost three times as much as the world average for hospitalization. I mean, you know, name your industry and where you see those. We pay almost twice as much for airfare as most countries in the world. Where you see concentration of corporate ownership, you see these obscene prices.
Well, I mean, let's talk about that, because the supposedly it is the idea that Bork introduced and like you say, was in many respects simply a fig leaf. Ideology that the way that you measure an illegal monopoly or antitrust, illegal trust, I should say, is simply a function of whether it makes things cheaper or more expensive, I guess, would make it illegal for consumers, broadly speaking, as opposed to, does this inhibit competition? Does this inhibit the ability of other businesses to enter into the market? Does this inhibit the ability of consumers to have some form of choice? And so price was just simply one factor in a more holistic and more sort of like, I guess, society-based, citizen-based concept of what was problematic about a monopoly. They narrowed it to just prices. So if that's the case, how is it that we have these monopolies that exist that also raise prices?
Well, it's a great question. And I'll give you an example. When we were living in Vermont, this was, 15 years ago, we got our internet service through a small local company. It was called Sovereignet. Vermont used to be a sovereign nation, so a lot of businesses in Vermont start with sovereign. And we paid $20 a month for internet service. And it was inexpensive, and it was carried over Verizon's telephone wires. And we had our telephone service in them as well, which was $25 a month. So it was carried over Verizon's telephone wires, and Sovereignet had to reimburse them for that. But at that point in time, you could choose any internet service provider you wanted. Now, fast forward, the FCC changed the rules, and now whoever owns the copper into your house can force you to buy exclusively from them. Which, by the way, is not the way it is in Europe. There's like 1,000 different internet companies on continental Europe. You can choose all kinds of companies. So it's like back when I was in Vermont. But the thing was that as the prices went up for access to internet service, and the same was true of cable TV, and the same was true of telephones, as the prices went up, people would bring claims, before the Justice Department, the Commerce Department, or the Federal Trade Commission. And the response was, well, there is no cheaper competitor. Right now, if you want to have telephone service, and where I live here in Portland, for at least 3/4 of the city, if you want to have telephone service, if you want to have internet service, or if you want to have cable TV service, you have one option: Comcast. Well, there's nobody competing with Comcast because they own the pipe into my house, and because there's no competition, there's no comparable lower price. So now I'm spending, 80, 90 bucks a month for internet service. It used to be $20 a month, and in France would be $20 a month. And they're saying, well, but you know, the price hasn't gone up because there's not a competitor offering a lower price. And that's because it's a monopoly. It's totally circular logic, Sam.
It's unbelievable. So the lack of a competitor justifies non-action to create a more competitive environment.
Exactly.
That's impressive.
Through Alice's rabbit hole.
It's impressive in its own way, I guess. All right. Well, you write about a bunch of examples of what the concentration of power and of market and of political power has done. You want to talk about the monopoly in milk, because this, this has a myriad of implications for us.
Yeah, with milk, I don't have that information right off the top of my head. But, the way it works, and I think probably everybody's familiar with it, we're really not talking about true monopoly here. John Rockefeller controlled 90% of the oil business in Ohio and Pennsylvania at the time that Ohio tried to break him up. Instead, people would say, well, I can fly on United or Delta or American. And yeah, you can. But the way it works is if United raises their prices $10, within 30 seconds, Delta has, on the same route, because their computers all monitor each other. So technically that's an oligopoly, but it functions as a monopoly. And, the bottom line is it's always an effort to keep out competition, to keep out small and medium-sized businesses, or to collaborate with large competitors so that it's not really competition.
So what is the answer to this? What's it going to take?
We need to enforce the damn laws. We need to enforce the laws, Sam. The Sherman Act, the Clayton Antitrust Act, the Sherman Act from the 1890s, the Clayton Act from the 1930s, the Antitrust Act of 1956, they're all still on the books. The Supreme Court bought some of Bork's logic and applied that in the late 70s in the GTE Sylvania case. But it's by no means definitive, and a small tweak of antitrust legislation could get around the Supreme Court quite easily. But the bottom line is that no president since Reagan has been willing to pay the political cost of challenging the giant monopolies, because between the monopoly power that they have and the political power that they have as a result of those two Supreme Court decisions in 76 and 78, they now have the ability to basically make or destroy any politician anywhere in the country, including the president. And so no president has been willing to take them on. But that's what needs to happen.
Well, give me, let's have a moment of where we fantasize that, and it's not exactly the most ambitious of fantasies, but it's certainly an important one, that Joe Biden wins the election. What do you think the chances are? Because certainly, right, there's a strain in the Democratic Party of a reemergence and a focus on, and I should say just the left broadly, on these issues of antitrust, right? And particularly Elizabeth Warren is one of the biggest champions of antitrust. Absolutely. In this respect. What is your sense as to the hostility or the excitement about reinvigorating our antitrust regime under a Biden administration?
I think that if we can, and this is why I wrote the book when I wrote the book, if we can wake America up to what's going on, to the fact that, you know, we're 40 years into a failed experiment, that has a disastrously failed experiment that has gutted the middle class and gutted the American business landscape and actually slowed down the rate of innovation and the rate of growth in our economy. When people realize this, you know, what's happening and how badly we're getting screwed, hopefully there would be some political pressure to do something about it. I would see Congress passing a 21st century version of the Sherman Antitrust Act and, you know, a President Biden acting on it. From the point of view of business in general, generically, when you look at what happened when Standard Oil was broken up by William Howard Taft, or when AT&T was broken up by Jimmy Carter, what you find is that, you know, if you owned a share of AT&T stock, you know, when Nixon first moved to break them up and just held it, that one share of stock became stock in seven baby Bell companies plus Bell Labs, which was renamed as something else. I'm forgetting right now. The value of them in combination, combined, it was much, much greater than that one share of stock that you owned. And it was the same thing with Standard Oil. If you owned a share of stock in Standard Oil before the breakup and afterwards you owned 34 shares of stock in smaller companies, your value had increased faster than anything else could have caused it to increase. So if we were to start saying to the big airlines, the big pharmaceutical companies, the big insurance companies, the big banks, the big hotel chains, the big fast food chains, the big internet, you know, the internet giants, you know, you can do business just fine, but you have to do it within these parameters so that competition is possible. You're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to break up into different divisions. Amazon needs to spin off their web cloud division. They need to spin off their branded retail division that competes with the companies that they sell on behalf of, for example. Or Facebook needs to spin off Instagram. I mean, buying Instagram is exactly the kind of thing that that Rockefeller used to do, you know, buy out his competitors that he couldn't destroy. Saying you have to break these up, what would happen is there would be an explosion in value in the stock market and in these companies as well. Plus, you would see an explosion in employment in the United States as these smaller companies now right. have to add, you know, new HR departments and new marketing departments and all these kind of things. I mean, every bit of evidence for almost 200 years, or at least 150 years, clearly shows that enforcing antitrust law, breaking up monopolies, works to everybody's advantage except the CEO of the monopoly that gets broken up. And even that person is usually really in good shape afterwards.
But their political power is diminished, of course, because they don't have as much money. They don't have as much control over our economy in various ways. Tom Hartman, thanks so much for joining us. The book is The Hidden History of Monopolies. From your word processor to Joe Biden's ears. appreciate your coming on.
Thank you, Sam. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be hanging out with you here. And thanks so much for having me.
Tom Hartman's new book, The Hidden History of Monopolies, How Big Business Destroyed the American Dream, is out in bookstores now. Go to TomHartman.com to learn more. Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. Special thank you to all of our free podcast subscribers who converted into supporters this past week. I cannot thank you enough. And if you're listening to the free show, consider becoming a member of the full show over at ROFpodcast.com. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. Check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm. My daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio.